Welcome to another episode of Side Hustle City, the podcast that helps you turn your side hustle into your main hustle, with your hosts, Adam Kaler and Kyle Stevie. Well, welcome back, everybody, to the Side Hustle City podcast. Today, we have with us a real estate guru, Joe Fairless, and also mentor to Kyle Stevie.
Yeah, I'm super excited about this one. I've mentioned Joe and Ashcroft Capital at least four or five times on this in our first 11 episodes because Joe means that much to me in terms of shattering what I thought was possible in terms of my life and reality of what I could possibly achieve, that I could get out of working for somebody else and I could actually have, you know, my own life. So I'm not going to sit here and even tell you what Joe's done. Because it's not going to be enough time. We got Joe for 30 minutes. We're going to actually have to be on a tight
time. Yeah. So if you listen to our podcast, you know, we go from an hour to 2 hours sometimes. So
because we can't shut up.
Yeah. But Joe's super successful, very popular guy, very busy guy. So we got you for a half an hour. So we appreciate your time and welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. And sounds like my dog was wanting to join the conversation. So I muted my microphone just a moment ago and hopefully he pipes down a little bit. But I'm looking forward to our conversation and thanks for the kind words, Kyle. I sincerely appreciate that.
Oh, no problem. For those that don't know Joe, he's you're a founder, partner at Ashcroft Capital. How much do you guys own in terms of money?
A billion.
Yeah.
That's a little over $1 billion worth of apartment communities.
With a B. And where are your primary places?
Dallas, Fort Worth is primary. And we're also in Jacksonville, Tampa, and Orlando.
Yeah. So that's way up there for all of our early listeners.
So it's cold in Cincinnati right now and it's raining and it pretty much feels like Edinburgh here right now. And Joe's got all this property in Dallas and Orlando and Jacksonville. And for some reason, he's in Cincinnati.
Yeah, well, some reason is my wife and her family are from here, so that is the reason. But I've grown to love Cincinnati. I love the small town vibe that Cincinnati has. I mean, I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, which was smaller than it is now when I was growing up, and then I moved to New York for 10 years after I graduated college. And then I moved to Cincinnati. I've seen both sides of what it's like to live in different areas. New York, no sunshine, and Cincinnati and Texas, you see sunshine and you have some room to roam a little bit. I prefer that.
Well, a lot of people call Cincinnati the biggest small city in America.
Mm,
and Chrissy Teigen just wrote something on Twitter the other day where she said, I've now come to grips with the fact that everyone is from Ohio. For some reason, she's meeting all these people from Ohio. I don't know what the deal is. But whenever I'm out of town, I meet people from Ohio too, specifically from Cincinnati. So
that's cool.
We do travel. We infiltrate many, many places. And apparently your wife infiltrated your heart. Got from Dallas.
Yes, she did. Very like a month into it. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay. So you move quick. There you go.
Yeah. Well, we didn't marry after a month, but I knew after a month that she was the love of my life.
That's awesome. So you take advantage of opportunities, and it sounds like you've done that in real estate. What got you started? So kid from Fort Worth, you know, you get out, you move to New York. What really got you into real estate and what got you into residential in particular?
I moved from Texas to New York City after I graduated, and I was making $30,000 working at an advertising agency. I was a junior project manager for a company called TBWA Shiat Day. So I was working on Madison Avenue, a very prestigious agency, but you know, my check was like $750 or $775 every 2 weeks.
Oh, and my rent was real about rough for New York. Real rough.
Yeah. I mean, I was living in East Flatbush, Brooklyn. Now, if I tell someone that and they're not from New York, they're like, oh, well, that's kind of cool. No. East Flatbush, Brooklyn was not a kind of cool place to live in 2005. It was dangerous. And statistically, it was the busiest police precinct in all the five boroughs.
Oh, so wow.
My mom visited me. And this was before, was it before Uber, 2005, 2006? I don't even know.
I think Uber, it was before Uber.
Yeah, so there wasn't Uber. There was a taxi and just taxis. And the taxi cab driver, when he saw my mom on the street hailing a ride, he said, "What are you doing here?" And she said, "Yeah, I'm visiting my son." He said, "Well, I wouldn't even come. I personally wouldn't come this area at night. I can't believe you're leaving your son here." So,
wow. So yeah, I think Biggie Smalls and Lil' Kim were from there, right?
I think so. Yeah, I think he's. Yeah, I think Biggie was. I don't know. I'm out of my element in that conversation. But yeah, I remember Flatbush being mentioned in Biggie's songs. And so needless to say, she was crying so hard at the airport, they wouldn't let her on the plane to fly home.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so it was a challenging area to live in for, but I only lived there for a year. And I then went to East Village. But you know, I kept my rent relatively low for the whole time I was in New York City. So I was in New York City for a decade, and I paid at most $1,200 in rent. And
wow, that's so a deal. Yeah, I had a buddy at Salesforce. He had a loft, and he was paying $4,000 a month for that, and that was like 5 years ago.
People made fun of me. My friends made fun of me. Like, why are you living like a college kid? Because I stayed in the same East Village apartment for 9 years. So East Flatbush, wow, 1 year, and then the rest of the 9 years, I was in East Village in a 2-bedroom apartment with no living room, a hallway. I mean, really just a counter and a stove and a bathroom. And there's a dorm style fridge.
Well, what was your income at this point? Like, I'm in advertising as well, and I work for a bunch of WPP agencies. So when you mention Sade, you know, that rings a bell. Mm-hmm. And you know, here in Cincinnati, this is a big advertising town because of Procter and Kroger and all that. So yeah, I come from kind of the same background. I've also been involved in real estate, but what kind of money were you making this whole time you're living in the East Village?
I started at 30,000, and at the end of my advertising career, which was about 9 years, my final salary was 150,000.
Okay, so you moved up the ranks. What were you at that point? Like, what kind of title did you have?
I was a vice president of an advertising agency. Okay. I was the youngest vice president at that agency, and so I was just, you know, that apartment. All my friends were, you know, you go from lots of roommates to maybe one roommate to a studio to a 1-bedroom. That's kind of what you do in New York City as you make more money. So that's what they were doing. And I never did that. I had tons of roommates. Like, I actually lived with turns out she was a prostitute. I didn't even know it, which is a whole nother story.
Wow. I'm talking about side hustle. You meet some characters in New York. You definitely do.
Gotta make the money.
Gotta make money. Hey, she had to make money, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I did stand-up comedy just to work on my public speaking skills. And that was definitely a story that I leveraged during my stand-up comedy bit for a hot second.
Sounds like you're pretty diverse. You've done a lot of things. And you know, being in advertising helps you really understand people and how people think.
Let him flesh this out, because his advertising is what he's done since then with his branding.
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, the advertising background helps, and I love it. I mean, I love the psychology of it. My favorite book, one of my favorite books is The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck.
Yes.
And I mean, I just dig that stuff. I soak it up. You asked how'd I get into residential? Well, you know, I was, eventually I realized that I needed to do something with the money as I kept my living expenses low. And I wanted to make money with the money that I had earned. So I kept my living expenses low, and then I was investing the money. My first investment was a CD, and I didn't even know what a CD was. I had to go into the bank as I was walking by it in New York, and I saw CD at, you know, whatever the interest rate was, incredibly low, but higher than what I was making in my bank account at the time. So I had $1,000. I gave them $1,000. And they kept it for 12 very long months. And then I got a return of about $16, I think.
So that's pretty good.
And then I realized I was taxed on the $16 later. I was like, what the hell? Like, there's got to be a better way. And so that's when I just started going into overdrive on studying. And I read Investing for Dummies. And then, you know, they talk about investing in stocks, bonds, investing in real estate, or investing in startups, LLCs. That's what they call it. So I just looked at the real estate, and I bought my first house while living in New York City, and that's how I got started.
What market did you buy that in? Was that in, that was in Dallas, correct?
Yeah, I was in Dallas. Yeah. Everything I've bought, I've never lived in the city at the time of buying a property that is an investment property. I've always lived in a different city at the time of purchase.
But you knew the city, I'm guessing. And you also knew that Dallas was about to blow up.
No, I didn't know Dallas was about to blow up, but I knew Dallas, Fort Worth, because I was from there, and I knew that there were some solid fundamentals. But I mean, come on, I was, you know, I was like, what, 26 years old or so. I didn't know a whole lot. I mean, if I was from, I don't know, Phoenix, for example, I might have invested in Phoenix and I would have a different path. So some of it's just luck.
What year was that, Joe?
Some of it's just I was investing where I was familiar, but I also knew the fundamentals of DFW were pretty good. But how much did I really know at 26 when I was just studying real estate? Some of it's, you know, just fortunate that I was from there.
What year was that?
It was October of 2009.
Oh, wow. So you've only been, I mean, you've been investing for 11 years and now you're up to $1 billion portfolio from nothing. I mean, from, you know, scraping pennies together. Yeah.
Yeah. I had student loans of $18,000 after college. I was paying those off. No, I didn't have any chunks of money coming my way from anybody. Obviously, I have help from people from a, you know, relationship standpoint, but no financial chunks of money help.
And this is interesting too. You said 2009. This is right after the housing crisis, or right at the beginning of the housing crisis, right?
I had to write a note to the lender. I remember writing the lender because they were concerned. I was in New York and I was buying a property, my very first property. I didn't even own a home. And that's what their concern was, because I was not a homeowner in for my primary residence, but I was trying to buy a house in Dallas while living in New York. And I had to write a letter about how it was cost prohibitive to buy in New York. So I was buying in Dallas for investment reasons. Yeah, it was tough to get a loan back then.
Made sense. Yeah. So how did you do that? I mean, was it just money you had saved up? Is that how you?
Yeah. Yeah. It was $20,000.
$20,000. Okay.
$20,000. I saved up money from my full-time job. And then I also worked as a nanny, a male nanny.
Oh.
Yeah. Didn't see that coming, did you?
No. It's just more diversity, more different. Yeah.
So in college, I worked at a daycare, not because I really loved kids. It was, I mean, if I'm, you know, speaking frankly, it was just I needed a job and I applied and they hired me. But then I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed working with kids who could pee and poop in the toilet already. So 3 and up is definitely what I enjoyed. So I did that in college. And then when I came to New York, it's tough as a man to get a babysitting job for understandably. I don't know if I would hire a man.
There's a little bit of a stranger danger feel to that.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I realized after posting on Craigslist, which is where, you know, I posted my info, I realized there were a certain category of people who replied, and it was one of two categories. It was a family with special needs kids, or a family where the dad wasn't around as often as, you know, it would, as
that makes sense,
would be desirable. Right. And therefore I had some families I worked with, and it was great. I worked with them and I worked with their kids and hung out with their kids, and I made money on the side. So I was, you know, my advertising, as you know, Adam, if you've got the advertising background, I mean, it's a crazy hours. You'll probably get in around 9 and you leave around 8 or 9, least in New York City.
Well, especially if you're a VP. I mean, you're there all the time, and you're working when you're not at work too.
Right. So I did that during the week, and then on the weekends, well, you go and you manny. I was manning. I usually had off on Saturday, and then on Sunday I'd get drunk and party with my friends on Saturday, and then on Sunday be right in there and hanging out with a kid and at Central Park or doing something else, playing with Legos. And I enjoyed that. So it was a combination of doing the manning as well as keeping my expenses low and then increasing the amount of money I was making my full-time job that I used to save up money.
Is this kind of like you were able to do without, which is something that comes up a lot, I think, with entrepreneurs in order to get where you want to be or even, you know, get started in something like a real estate. I mean, you have to do without. And you mentioned, I mean, you got friends who are moving on up in the world and they're, you know, as their salaries increase, you know, more money, more problems. Mm-hmm. You know, you get more money, you think you can spend more money, right? Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, you're in a 2-bedroom apartment spending $4,000 a month in, you know, the East Village or somewhere where somebody like you, you know, you're staying in the same place, your income's going up, but you're saving. And you're also working a weekend job, which is also bringing you more money and probably connections to people as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. The important ingredient there is to have a vision for where you want to go. Because if you're just mindlessly going along the path of life and you don't have a vision for where you want to go, then it's easy to get caught up in the shiny objects. For example, I had no desire to be in New York City in a 2-bedroom apartment, raising a family. I'm from Texas. I want some space. I want to, you know, I want something more like that. And so I wasn't going to get caught up in to the creature comforts of more, a little incrementally more space in New York when I knew that wasn't going to scratch the itch. I wanted something completely different. And I wasn't going to use resources to get a little bit better when I knew that'd set me back a lot. I wanted to combine all the or hold on to those resources, the money, and then get something, pursue the larger vision and be able to capitalize on it whenever I could.
So you weren't collecting things, you were collecting money, you were collecting capital as a way to enrich yourself and invest
in your
bigger dreams.
I had nothing when I moved. I mean, when I moved from New York City to Cincinnati, I had basically nothing. And
the wife's been there the whole time when you had nothing, sounds like.
Yeah, she was there in 2013. So she was there during the worst part of my business life. So the reason why I moved to Cincinnati is I had a property here, and I went from 4 single family homes to then my next deal was 168 units.
How do you jump from 4 single families? Because I've got 4 single families too, and they're the biggest pain in the ass.
He's got a book.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, blissful ignorance is how you do that.
Yeah.
And it's not a good thing.
I'm looking at a 12 unit right now. I've been renting property for 15 years now, and I'm just now looking at a multifamily.
Well, we can pitch his book right now. You can read his book and you'll learn how to do the syndication.
Yeah. What's the book called?
Best Ever Apartment Syndication Book.
It takes you step by step from I know nothing to I have $1 billion worth of rental properties.
See, this is awesome.
Cities.
This is what we need. And I wish more people would lay it out like that. I wish more people would explain to folks how things are done, because I feel like if there's a system in place or if there's something that I can follow, it makes me more likely to actually do it than somebody just saying, hey, I got $1 billion in property and I kind of did it like this and I got lucky here and I got lucky there.
Joe has systems on top of systems.
See, that's what people
He's
need.
He's the most organized. If you ever listened to his podcast, if you want to pitch that to Joe.
Yeah, what's the podcast, Joe?
Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show.
Awesome. So if anybody's listening to the podcast and you want to learn more about real estate, actually, our real estate podcast episodes are some of the most popular ones. I mean, the one that Osh did is probably 3 times more popular than our average podcast.
Well, Osh is one of my good friends. I mean, he's a entertaining guy to begin with, and he speaks from the heart, and he's got a contrarian perspective as it relates to most real estate investors. And it works for him, and it would work for others if they implement it. So I understand.
Well, he even offered to help people, like personally help
people.
That's
how
he
is.
He said, bring me 3 properties and I will help you. I don't know if he had any takers, but I mean, I just see that, you know, there's a lot of people out there, maybe some people listening to the podcast here. you've got a lot of people who want to do something, and then you have people who actually act on that, right?
Some people need to know what to do. And that's what's so great about Joe. But there's no bullshit with Joe. It is, there's like when he's doing his intro on his podcast, none of the fluffy stuff. And it's very much, okay, what did you do this? Did you do this? Did you do this? And if you have any excuse, it's like, no, do not try to have an excuse. You just didn't do it right.
We were looking at your website. It looks like there's a $25,000 minimum to get into most deals.
Yeah, for all of our deals.
And you have to be an accredited investor, I'm guessing.
You do.
Okay. Okay. And so this is a little bit different. What do you think about a lot of these real estate websites that are out here now? I think a lot of them are run by like Fundrise. They're run by actual real estate agents, and they get in on these deals and then they syndicate those out to even unaccredited investors. Is there anything keeping you from doing something like a Fundrise with even unaccredited folks?
Yeah, we register under 506C as in cat. So we can publicly advertise our deals when we have them. And one stipulation of being able to publicly advertise deals is you can only bring in accredited investors.
And I'm guessing that also kind of helps you weed out potential bad investors, like people who are going to be more of a problem than what they're worth.
Yes, that's very true.
Because some folks, you know, $25,000, they make that in a day and they're like, here you go, you know, turn it into something for me. And they've got other things going on. They're not going to sit here and dwell on this thing and lose sleep over it. Where, you know, the smaller investors, I mean, $25,000 is a giant chunk of change to most unaccredited investors.
They would take out a loan to do it because it would return better than the interest they were paying on the loan.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then all of a sudden they're emotionally invested and now you're getting phone calls and emails and.
Yeah. And Joe, I know we don't got a lot of time with you, but how do you go from these four single families into this multifamily? Like, did you have to bring other investors in? Did you have to go on with a group? Is that when, you know, the light came on and you were like, hey, I need to start a company and do this and bring more people in?
So I raised the money from 12 investors. I thought I could raise about $200,000 when I started looking at deals. And this deal was presented to me as a creative financing deal, master lease with option to purchase for real estate people who are listening. And they said it's going to be about a $500,000 raise. I know you said you can, or $500,000 worth of equity. I know you said you've got about two, but can you swing five? And I'm like, well, you know, I can stretch that. Yeah, I think I can do it, assuming that the deal makes sense. This in and of itself could be a very, very long conversation with lots of lessons learned, because the deal ended up losing money. And I lost $1 million before I made $1 million. And I didn't have $1 million to lose. And so what I did is I told each of those 12 investors that I would pay them back personally. And I'd not only pay them back personally, I'd also give them 14% annualized return. However long that took, I'd make a payment every month to them. And that's what I did. I paid them for about 2 years or so. I have those 12 investors for life.
That's a huge thing. I mean, you know, most investors, they understand the risk. I mean, going into something like that, you know, they know that they could lose money and, you know, you're not required necessarily to pay them back, but you're saying you did it. This was one of your first big deals. You didn't want to lose those folks. So you thought, hey, you know, if I pay these guys back, they're going to stick around.
No, I didn't think that. I didn't really care a whole lot about their thoughts. I cared about who I am and who I'm proud to be. That's really it. Because ultimately, that's the person I spend the most time with.
Sure, sure.
So that was. I mean, it didn't really matter. I could have, you know, disliked them, which, you know, I like each and every one of them. But it was really about that, which I know I didn't directly answer your question of how I got into it, but I know, maybe can we do another part, another.
Yeah, we can do a part two to this. This could be part one, and then we'll do a part two to get in more.
I mean, what you know about branding, subject matter expert, I mean, pretty much everything that we've been trying to harp on for for these podcasts. And, I think it would take a lot of time. Yeah,
I've got some. Another thing we'll talk about on the next one is what I call my Alice, A-L-I-C-E. It's something I created about 2 years ago. August 15th, 2018. And it's called, and Alice stands for Activity Level Income Category Exercise. So it tracks all the different types of income streams I have, and it categorizes them into passive, semi-passive, one-off, and one-off active, and then ongoing active. And I think just having something like this for your listeners will be helpful. So we can talk about that too.
Excellent.
That's awesome. That's a good,
another call to jump.
That's a good place to leave it. Yeah. People get excited about the next episode. You met Joe on this one, and he's going to go into a little more detail on his systems in the next episode. So Joe, it was awesome to meet you. Enjoy the rest of the day. Enjoy your holiday weekend, and we'll get with you again on the next episode.
Cool. Looking forward to it. Grateful to be on.
When are we going to play one-on-one in that, on that basketball court?
Man, next weekend. Come on. Come on over.
All right.
All right. See you guys.
See you, Joe.
Bye. Bye.